today it's my pleasure to be talking to Catherine Dawson, who you'll be able to tell us your title. I believe you were a technical director, but we're at Melcourt. Now, firstly, can you tell us a little bit, listeners, about Melcourt and indeed your role, for those who don't know about the company?
Certainly, Jonathan, certainly. Yes, for many years I've been technical director of Melcourt. I'm not retiring yet, but I'm on a trajectory to retire, and so I have resigned as a director of Melcourt, but I'm still very much there, still dealing very much with technical matters, and so to all intents and purposes, nothing has really changed. So Melcourt, we're celebrating our 40th birthday this year. The company was started in 1983 by a forester who saw that there was a role for bark products, with a principal raw material in those days, and bark's still very much at the core of what we do. And so John Latter, who's long retired, but really was the driving force in the early years of Melcourt, set up the company, and they became real specialists for the landscape industry, mulching, soil improvers, and planting media. It's easy to forget that in the early 1980s, bark mulch just wasn't really a thing in this country. But it rapidly became it when local authorities in particular realized that the use of bark mulch could really save on the labor costs of maintaining public parks, public planting, planted up beds and that kind of thing. So the company really took off. And then in the later 1980s, the peat debate, and it does go back that far, raised its head. And so professional nurserymen started to look for, or some growers anyway, for alternatives to peat. But equally, bark had found a place as an ameliorant for peat. Peat's been the staple ingredient for professional growing and indeed amateur for decades. But on its own, particularly for nursery stock, for anything that stays in the pot for any length of time, peat can gradually lose its structure, which isn't great for plant root health. You need air in there as well as moisture and nutrients. So bark was known to professional nurserymen in those days as an ameliorant. And so gradually Melcourt got pulled into that area of products as well. And then as the writing on the wall got a bit bigger for peat and peat reduction, we started going into the finer bark materials, which were actual replacements for peat. And on it went from there. So we introduced our first professional peat-free growing medium 21 years ago in 2001. We never have dealt with peat because unless you were sitting on a peat bog, there was nothing in it for us to get involved in peat at all. So we've been real specialists in this area for many, many years. And gradually the sectors we cover, landscaping is still very much what we do, landscape products, that is, products for growers, ingredients for growing media, ready-to-use peat-free growing media. We launched a retail range in 2014, peat-free growing media, the Silver Grow range. We do a little bit of animal bedding and one or two more industrial processes like biofilters. And we even sell decorative aggregates, grits and gravels. We do a lovely potting grits now, and so we've gradually expanded out, and we supply garden centres, builders, merchants, professional growers, landscapers. It's quite broad. So 40 years on, we're still sort of looking at new areas, really. So yeah, it's very exciting.
That sounds fascinating. Now we touched upon one of I guess the biggest issues or one of the big issues that's facing both professional horticulture and indeed amateur gardeners. And I have used peat in the past, so I kind of, again, as an amateur gardener, understand its properties. I am now peat-free and it's taken some time for me to get what works for me right. But when I say that, the first thing that people, or certainly some gardeners, often say back to me is, well, all peat-free, it's complete rubbish. What do you say to the people like that?
I think I say that it's very easy to do these sort of throwaway comments. It's, you know, all peat-free compost is rubbish. We know what it takes to thoroughly test a compost, whether it's peat-based or whatever it is. And others are doing this very seriously. And so it's not just us that would say that, that's a, to be frank, that's not a sensible comment because all peat-free isn't rubbish. We're selling peat-free, so you might think, well, you know, she's bound to say that. But in fact, there's plenty of independent testing going on, not least the Consumers Association Gardening Witch magazine. There's an annual test of composts. And the peat-frees, including our own, are frequently at the top of the list. And in fact, Gardening Witch, I don't think they even test peat-based composts anymore now. They use them as controls, and very frequently, and anybody can look this up, the reports show that the peat-frees in a very controlled environment, rather than somebody just trying, getting bad results, and then branding all peat-frees as rubbish, there's a lady called she styles herself as Pumpkin Beth, who does some of the most detailed trials you'll ever see across a range of growing media. They're available on her website. And again, independent testing, very, very carefully done. And equally, I would say we've been selling our peat-free composts to growers for over 20 years, at a time when many of them don't even tell their customers that it's peat-free, but they're in a very competitive commercial market. So they're doing it for very good technical reasons rather than anything to do with any sort of environmental lobby. And I think that speaks volumes, because some of these customers, they're some of the biggest names in the industry. They're not doing it for fun. They're doing it because it works. So for anyone who says that all peat-free compost is rubbish, I totally disagree. However, we all know, I mean, I'm a gardener myself, and there's nothing worse than plant failure, seedling failure at this time of year when every week matters. If somebody does get bad results, and there are some poor products out there, I think mostly they're getting better, but there are still poor products out there. It is very disheartening. And that is when you can see that the comment, all peat-free compost is rubbish, might come from the lips of somebody who's had perhaps a series of bad results. And I can understand it, but it just isn't true.
You've already alluded or mentioned the fact that the peat debate, let's call it, it isn't something new. It's been around for a while. There was a recent poll of growers, and by that I'm talking about professional growers in Horticulture Week, that suggested that 20% of them, when they've filled in the survey, cannot go peat-free. Does that statistic surprise you?
Yes and no. It tells us nothing about the volume that 20%... is that 20% of growers or 20% of the volume of compost that's used? It suggests it's 20% of actual numbers of growers. I think there are specialist areas in some plant production. For instance, many of the lettuces and some of the brassicas that we eat start life in blocks. Blocking compost is traditionally made out of a very finely textured peat. It needs to be very fine in order to block properly. And although you can make blocking compost without peat, and it can work, nobody's come up at the moment with anything that's as cheap, because this is a very cheap product as well, as it happens, very specialised, but tends to be at the bottom end of the price range. It's not an area that Melcourt ourselves have ever been interested in particularly. It's not our special area, and our materials don't lend themselves to blocking. Our materials were included in some trials that Horticulture Research International did a few years ago, and it can be done, but not routinely, not at the price that these growers want to pay. A lot of ericaceous growers, you know, have said, oh, it can't be done. We've got growers growing very successfully without use of peat for ericaceous. So I think some growers are saying they can't do it. Perhaps they've had bad results with the products they've tried. I am surprised. I don't think it has to be as high as 20%. Some special areas may take longer, but even carnivorous plants, which require very low pH, very low nutrient compost, we're seeing some very good results with some peat trees now in some work that we're doing with the RHS. So, this figure will go down.
I mean, do you sense, you know, given the fact that you've already said that, you know, the debate's been around a while, that there's a reason to believe that for commercial growers, you know, a ban might not come into place for 7 years. Do you sense that actually what sometimes you're hearing is when people say they can't move over to peat, it's actually that they, peat free, sorry, it's that they don't want to because it's other reasons such as cost, which you've already mentioned. Have you sensed that there's, in some quarters, there's just an unwillingness to try the alternative and trial it properly, given the length of time that growers still have to do that?
I think there could well be that. And one of the things that we've found over the years is that many growers who want, they agree with the principle of peat reduction, they seem to find it very straightforward. Those that don't seem to find it difficult. And I think there's a huge psychological element to this. It's like any decision that we as people make, is that if we want something to work, generally we find a way. And so some of the unwillingness, we've been saying to growers for many, many years, bearing in mind, it was David Bellamy back in the 1970s, that far back, that this issue about the fact that peat should be left where it is, that was when it was first mooted. It sort of came to growers' consciousness and the industry's consciousness in the very late 1980s. We've been saying to growers for many years, this is going to happen, and it is. Don't, even if you don't want to make the change right now, know what you would do if you had to. Get the trials done now. It takes time to get used to a new medium. So I think some of them have been hoping perhaps that it will go away, and that at one stage, 2030 was the date mooted for professional growers to be peat free by, which felt a long way off. But it does take a bit of time, particularly if you're not particularly keen that you're having to do it. If you feel you're being forced into it, there's a bit of a psychological element there that doesn't help. So, but many, many growers, we don't come across many growers now who are really still, you know, pretending it's not going to happen or believing it's not going to happen. So there is an unwillingness amongst some growers, but we don't come across many anymore, not anymore.
For growers, and I'm probably talking on a larger scale, who, rather than an individual gardener, who may be struggling, does Melcorp provide any advice or assistance in terms of changing to peat-free, be it sort of a slightly different recipe, if that's the right word, for their specific planting?
Absolutely. It's what we do. It's what we're good at. We've got a strong technical team and very knowledgeable. Our two technical sales managers were both growers in their former lives, and so they really understand growers and growing. And so yes, we go out, we provide them with advice, we provide them with samples, we talk to them, we monitor their trials if that's what they're doing, we tell them what other people are doing, so that it people who first started, I mean, one of our very good customers for a long, long time now is Hillier Nurseries, a very large nursery down in the south. They've been using our peat-free medium for their containerized trees probably even two decades. And that's quite a strong message for somebody else who might be thinking, well, you know, I don't know about this, what should I be doing? If they hear that somebody who is a market leader is doing it, kind of makes the whole thing more accessible. Yeah. But certainly we go out to growers and we give them whatever time they need to help them. There's an awful lot of technical help out there that grow. They don't have to struggle on their own. Go out there and use what help is available, either from us or indeed others who are supplying the commercial market.
I specifically grow and as we've spoken about, I use Melcorp products. I grow Cosmos and Hollyhocks. In your experience, what are the biggest challenges or changes to growing practices that using peat free requires? So for me, I definitely had to work out how I best watered my seedlings and plants, and then sort of feeding them. Is that two of the big issues that people are going to have to look at when they move from using peat to peat free, or are there more?
I think watering and feeding are two of the biggest issues in growing, whatever you're growing in. And so, it's not particularly harder with peat-free, but it can be different depending on the mix you're using. One thing, the water holding capacity of peat-free is often held up as being, it's less. Some of our customers say, it holds more moisture. So, there's always a spectrum. But actually, one thing is that sometimes people don't realize this, that a growing medium, I know that you will understand this, Jonathan, a growing medium has a water capacity. So you can add water up to a point. You get to a point where it won't hold anymore. It just can't. And so that water drains away. And if you think it's not easy to look at a compost and see when it's got to that stage, but it is a little bit like having a full jug of water. Nobody would try and make a full jug of water hold any more water, because it's plainly obvious it's not going to do it. Now, a growing medium will not hold any more moisture than its potential, than its ability to do that. If more water is added at that point, it will simply just drain away, and with it, it'll take nutrients. And so if the compost you're using is holding less moisture than the previous peat one, learn that don't just keep adding the water. The plant isn't going to need any more moisture, but you may have to shorten the watering interval, but not by a lot. And many growers don't notice any difference at all. When we do our trials, we tend to we randomize all the different treatment mixes, and everything gets watered the same. We always have a peat-based control. And we rarely find that there's any particular difference. We've tried to design our mixes so that they do, they are as easy to use as peat-based ones, because there's so much, when you're a professional grower and you're a gardener, there's so much to do to get it right. We don't want to put any extra barriers in the way of success. On the feeding front, again, it is one of the comments that people come up with, and I do believe that one of the problems is it's not that the compost requires more nutrient. It's just that if the watering is too much, it can be taking some of the nutrient away with it.
So it could almost be people are watering to excess, and it's washing the feed out, and they're not realizing that they should actually water less, but at more regular intervals.
That's exactly right, and that the appearance of peat trees needing more nutrient may simply be that too much nutrient is actually being leached away, because none of these loamless, soil-free mixes, peat included, none of them are as good at hanging on to fertilizers, resisting leaching as soil. Soil is far more chemically active. And so you do have to be careful. And it's one of the reasons why over the years the industry has taken to using controlled release fertilizers such as Osmocote. And many of our grower customers will have our mixes with controlled release fertilizer already added. And these just pump out a little bit of nutrient over a long period of time. And that is a way of resisting leaching and taking care not to have all the nutrient in an available form right at the beginning, and then it is very subject to leaching. So that's an industry norm, and those controlled release fertilizer granules are available in garden centers, and they're very useful for things like hanging baskets or tubs, bedding plant containers, or any permanent tubs. They're a very good way of monitoring or just regulating the amount of nutrient that is available at any one time, and helping you not to, because we all overwater, we all overwater from time to time. Even experienced growers will do that. But that is one of the things to look out for.
Some critics of moving to peat free, when they don't see the point, they suggest, well, it's not environmentally friendly because you have to ship in coir and perhaps you have to use wetting agents and perhaps you have to add more feed, and that all has an extra environmental impact. Do you have a view on that?
Yes, I think it's very important. We really don't want a sort of frying pan into the fire situation. We may not want to use peat, but are the alternatives that we're using any more environmentally friendly? And there is now the new responsible sourcing of growing media scheme, which absolutely looks at all of this. And for instance, you mentioned coir, which is a byproduct of the coconut industry that gets shipped in from either India or Sri Lanka. And a very common view is, it can't be good coming all that way. Well, what this scheme does is it allows us to interrogate that a bit more closely. So we look at the energy that's involved in firstly preparing it from the raw ingredient, getting it ready to be shipped over. Shipping is one of the lowest emitters of carbon dioxide per kilometre, per tonne of materials that we're using. And so once we've interrogated all of that information and added up all the energy that's used to continue with this example of coir, but we do it across all of our ingredients, we can actually see that it doesn't compare so badly. So the scheme takes 7 different criteria, one of which is the social impacts of what we're doing, but we count up the energy, we look at the amount of water that any ingredient uses, we look at any pollution, any waste that's generated, we look at the impact of an ingredient on habitat and biodiversity, and we look at the renewability of it. So if you take something like peat or indeed perlite or vermiculite, which are both derived from rocks, those are plainly, they're not in any human scale renewable. If you go to the other end of the scale and you look at green compost, for example, that's renewable within a very short time scale. So the scheme actually basically scores all of these impacts, and we come up with a score from a product with, you know, putting together all the ingredients that are in that product. And there is a website now that you can look at, and you can check the scores of the products that are taking part in the scheme. It's responsiblesourcing.org.uk.
Fantastic. Now, if I go to a garden centre and I see a Melcourt product, and I'm not going to pick a specific one, but not wanting you to betray any trade secrets, what's that compost made of? What's in that bag?
Yes, no, it's a good and very valid question, because a lot of compost brands, they don't actually tell you. They'll say it's organic matter, or they'll say it's recycled materials, but they don't actually tell you what it is. Ours, we're quite plain. We put it on the back of our bags. Ours is a blend of bark and wood fibre, which are both co-products of the forest industry in the UK. We do use coir ourselves in small quantities, because it provides a moisture holding capacity that our other materials can't easily do. So we have this nice blend. And so most of the composts of ours that either growers are using or our retail silver grow is a blend of bark, wood fibre and coir. Now, some of the organic products that we do, because those products are certified by the Soil Association, there are one or two ingredients that we have to change because of that. And so in our organic products, we use a small amount of green compost, for example. You may want to ask about that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen the... I know as an individual grower, I can get some, and I do kind of rank my compost and give some the gold medal and some use for what I would regard as less important. And quite often I'll buy some locally produced green waste compost and use it for mulching or filling up the bottom of tubs. And the reason I don't risk it on my precious seedlings is that I'm often worried that if it's made from stuff that goes in my recycling bin, I don't know what the next door neighbour puts in it, and if it's got the residue of pesticides, that can be an issue. Whereas you guys have a green waste product that's classified as organic. So how do you manage to have that as an organic product when it must be really hard to know what goes into the green waste?
Well, firstly, we don't have a pure green waste, right. And we'd call it green compost. By the time we get it, it's an ingredient. It's not a waste anymore. It's green compost, so just a terminology sort of thing there. But we use small amounts of green compost in some of our mixes. That is allowed by the Soil Association, which may seem odd, but it is. But I think that, you know, the classification is one thing. What's actually happening? Yes, anybody can put anything in a green bin, and it's very, very difficult for the waste handler to know. They can pick out the plastic bags, but they can't pick out the sort of feed and weed that somebody might have decided to pop in there as well. The reality is we do a lot of testing. Most pesticides would denature under the composting process, and it's a very, very, it's like a giant version of your home compost heap. And there is a certification scheme. So a responsible organization, and certainly at Melcourt, you would only buy what's known as PAS 100 green compost. So that means it's been through a testing protocol, that ensures, you know, they're not testing every last drop, but there is a protocol, an agreed protocol, which does include testing for pesticides using a field bean, a broad bean test. With any legume is, as you probably know, Jonathan, is very sensitive to herbicide residue. So we regularly test our green compost. We only buy from one trusted organization. And I think the volumes that these waste handlers are handling is so enormous that even if some irresponsible householders have tipped something nasty in there, that in general, what we find is that the dilution is so great that it's very rare to pick up anything dangerous. But I think you're right to be careful. Another material that can suffer from this same thing, of course, is manure, because there's a grazing herbicide that is resistant to going through the animal. It doesn't get denatured at that point, and it's resistant to composting. And there's been an awful lot of terrible instances of contaminated animal manures getting onto allotment sites or elsewhere and causing terrible herbicide damage. But what we do, we're very aware of the problem. We only use green compost in very low volumes in our mixes, and we've tested it anyway. But you're right to raise it as a potential problem.
I don't particularly like this phrase, but I know it's been used. Do you believe it's just environmental zealots that are pushing the peat-free agenda? I know that's been said certainly more than once. It's just environmentalists that want this done, and there's no real reason to stop using peat.
Yes, I don't like that phrase either. And I mean, obviously there are. It's not. There are plenty of very serious academics that really know what they're talking about, who have demonstrated the very, very important job that peat does in situ. And it's not only, you know, the big one, the thing that's, I think, turned the head of government in the end was the carbon store that an undisturbed peatland becomes and is. It's absolutely massive. But also peatland plays a very important role in things like flood protection. That if you think of the Peak District, Derbyshire, there's an awful lot of money going into rehabilitating those upland peatlands, not necessarily the type that horticulture uses, but it's nevertheless, it's peat. It's doing a very good job of hooking up all the rainfall and preventing that sort of dripping down into urban areas, you know, Sheffield, Chesterfield, Manchester. Whereas a few years ago they were trying to make the uplands more productive by draining the peatland, there's now a massive amount of work and money going into blocking up the drains, rehabilitating the peatland, getting them growing again so they can do this very important job of people. So no, it's not just environmental zealots going mad. There are very, very real reasons. But it does come down to the fact that everything we do has an impact, and this is why the responsible sourcing scheme is so important, that it allows individuals to look at these things more closely than has been possible. There's been a lot of emotion surrounding this issue, and a lot of misinformation, and a lot of, you know, what people think to be the case. Like, for instance, the COIA coming all that way. Actually, it's really important that we get down to real evidence, real science, rather than just what we think might be the case.
I've worked in various different sectors and in the political arena, and at times I've had to go and tell my chief executive that a decision is going to be taken, and it's going to be taken within 12 months, and it's going to cost the organisation hundreds of millions of pounds and the sector billions of pounds. And that decision came from nowhere and happened within 12 months, and we had to scramble to live with it. So with that analogy, do you think if it's a possible 7 years period before peat is withdrawn for commercial growers, isn't that long enough for nurseries to find a formulation that works for them?
I think the thing I would say about that is that any grower who hasn't sort of had their ear to the ground on this, given that this has been around since, 1989, and plenty of people like us and many others have been saying that don't get right up to the wall and have to suddenly change. So I do believe that there are very few growers who aren't at least aware of this, and many have done things about it. Some are doing it on a gradual process, others are changing to 100% peat free from a peat-based formulation. There are various different ways of doing it, and all can be very successful. In fact, the government at the moment, although the 2024 ban for retail bagged compost is very much in place, subject to parliamentary process, and it does need to go through Parliament, but that one, there seems to be no question about that. We're still waiting to hear from government whether the exemption for growers from that will finish in 2028 or indeed 2030. It hasn't been said. So it could be 4 years time. Who knows at the moment, but we should be hearing very soon. Even 4 years for many growers should be enough. But really, we would say, don't leave it any longer. Hear what's going on. There's no surprise about any of this. It's even 4 years for most growers should be possible, given that there is so much information from people like us and others already out there. You can benefit from the work that others have already gone through.
On that subject, if this all comes to pass, is there actually enough peat-free compost to go around come the ban?
Well, if it happened, if the government turned around and said, right, banned tomorrow, no, they wouldn't, because obviously the infrastructure has to have time to develop. But the figure for the amount of peat left to be replaced in the UK in total, professional growers and amateur gardeners. In 2021, it was something like 34-35% of the total 5 million cubic metres of growing media was still peat. We're just waiting for the 2022 figures to be published. They're not that we've all had to, we all feed our figures in so that they can be crunched and a global figure given out. And the indications are that 35% is going to be even lower this coming year. So we're looking at replacing maybe 1 million cubic meters or thereabouts, something like that. There is a huge amount of work. Commerce doesn't like a vacuum. There's a huge amount of work going in. We know in our industry, Melcourt is owned by two shareholders who are both very much into the forest world, if you like. So we have very good intelligence on, what's coming down the pipes, what's available. And there's more and more forest residue becoming available. One of the reasons being the growth of the biomass industry, the use of wood for burning for power. But that industry cannot use the fine material. They can only use wood chip. And so the 0 to 10 size fraction from those wood materials that are being burnt has to be screened out, and that is exactly the resource that our industry needs. And so, I think it can be done, given that we've got another few years to do it. It's happening already, and if you look at the reduction in peat, in particularly in these very recent years, it's happening, and I do believe it's possible.
Critics bemoan the cost of peat-free, although, to be frank, given the way prices are going everywhere, critics bemoan the price of everything at the moment. But prices have gone up. What do you say to people who may have been used to buying a cheap and cheerful bag of 80% peat and were that was cheap to dig up, but peat-free can be a little bit more expensive?
Yeah, it can. Peat will go up, and I think the environmental cost of peat, of course, hasn't been factored into the price we've been paying. And composts have hardly gone up in price. We calculated that if inflation, which of course has been very low, other than in this past year or two, a bag of compost would have been £13-14 if it had gone up the way that other things that, a bottle of wine or a pint of beer. Compost has been very cheap because there's been a bit of a price war with some of the very big producers. And so consumers have done very, very well out of that. What I would say is that if you're paying £8 or £9 for a 50-litre bag of good peat-free compost, firstly, it costs money to do the job properly, all the R&D and all the trials and testing that has to go into it, the proper use of resources, proper choice of resources, good quality every time, consistency. It costs money. And if you're paying £8 for a bag of compost, £9, even £10, what you can do with 50 litres of compost, the number of seedlings you can grow, the number of, seedlings you can prick out and pot on, the tubs that you can produce, and the joy, in fact, The growing medium, the compost, is the start of successful gardening. Without that, nothing else can happen in terms of anything that's being done in a pot. And so let's actually think of it not as a comparison with something that's been artificially cheap for many, many years and has an environmental cost to it. Let's go for something and sort of cherish the joy that a bag of compost can bring. I feel quite strongly about that for ages, compost has been the sort of cheap brown stuff that you buy at the end of your trip to the garden centre.
So I guess the message is that you're telling people, and I agree to be fair, is that people need to value their compost a little bit more.
They need to source it carefully and value it and use it when it's fresh. That's another thing that we would say. That one difference, peat is, and certainly I would never deride peat. Peat is the most brilliant growing medium. Nobody can deny that. It's very easy to use and it's easy to manage and all of those things, I would never say anything against peat in that respect. But it's essentially inert. It doesn't carry a microbial population. Most of the alternatives do, because they're much more recent organic matter, if you like. They do carry it. Anything that's been composted, like your own garden compost, has a microbial population, which, of course, we're beginning to understand now is a really, really good thing. Many, many benefits come from that. But one of the things about that is when you put a compost in a bag on a garden centre shelf, the microbes are there and they're doing things, and so the things can change. And so although manufacturers such as ourselves, we take steps to manage that as best we can, even a peat compost is best when used fresh. So try not to use up your old compost from last year on large tubs and containers for bulbs in the autumn or that kind of thing, or use it as a soil ameliorant. Start the year with a good fresh compost, and that's another way to really succeed.
Now, if a customer's used peat, an amateur customer used peat all their life, and they today went and swapped to your product, what advice would you give them to help them grow successfully?
Look closely at how they water it. Don't overwater it, but sure, it's this balance between making sure that the compost is correctly moist at the start of the process. So if you've obviously if you've sown seeds, that's something else. You just need to make sure that the one thing about seeds that I think, because a lot of people say they struggle, and it's all about that contact between the seed and the moisture that it needs. And the consistent moisture, and it's worse for a seed to start off well moisturized, if you like, and then dry out than it is for to never have enough moisture in the first place, because it'll sit there until it has got enough moisture. So I would say moisture control. And learn about the product. Learn many peat alternatives. This is often said, and it's probably true of ours as well. They can look dry on the top when, in fact, they're adequately moist underneath. And that, of course, is what can lead to that overwatering that we were talking about earlier. So learn the weight of a well watered, not overwatered, not underwatered pot. Learn the weight of what that feels like. Learn to recognize, stick your finger in, or just lift that top layer and have a look and see how moist it is underneath. And that, I would say, is one of the keys to success. I think another thing, I once heard a well-known head gardener say that he felt that the difference between amateur gardeners and professional gardeners is the amount of supplementary feed that they use, whatever the compost is, that many of us don't think about supplementary feeding. But most growing media off the shelf have got enough in fertilizer in there for the first 4 to 6 weeks. So be prepared to supplementary feed or to use the Osmocote granules. You can even make your own comfrey feed in the garden. But if you want optimum performance, be prepared to do that. But I think the main difference would probably be watering. It's not that different. I wouldn't want anybody to get hung up on that. But I think use your powers of observation, which you should be doing anyway. To be a successful gardener, observation is one of the biggest things you can do to help yourself, really.
And a final question is, if people want to know where they can get hold of your products, if they've never seen them before, where should they go?
If they go to melcourt.co.uk, we've got a great big tab on the homepage that says where to buy, and then a series of drop-down boxes, depending on which product you want, whether it's a mulch or a silver grow, and then it'll lead you to your nearest garden centre stockist. And that's a live system. And we would always recommend ringing in advance, because you don't know that somebody's just gone in and bought the last bags, but particularly we're getting into the busiest period. But melcourt.co.uk and then the where to go tab, but they can always ring us. If they ring Melcourt, they'll get straight through to a real person, and we'll do our very best to be helpful.
Catherine Dawson, I could talk on this subject forever because I think it's fascinating, but thank you for talking to us today.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure, Jonathan. Thank you.